Welcome to the pod, everyone. A shout out to SGS.
Hey, Rusty, why are we partnering with SGS?
Some good people there. Pretty excited about their sports coaching courses and sports courses. Keen to make them industry ready, so when people leave, they're able to go and transfer it to any kind of industries, coaching, teaching, being an analyst, business, whatever it might be. So I think it's pretty exciting times, really.
So what's so special about their degree courses that others won't be doing?
I think it'll be lots of real good partnerships, opportunities for people to get into different contexts and learn and practice. It'll be feel very applied. People will be stretched and supported and will leave ready to just go and thrive in the big old world out there.
SGS College is the home of Bristol's higher education sports programmes. The programmes are designed to develop unique, innovative and creative sports practitioners ready for industry. Do you want to be a coach or teacher of the future? Start your journey here at SGS College and become more than just a graduate. Visit sgscol.ac.uk to apply now.
Dave Slemon, thank you very much for joining us on the pod. How are you, mate? You're looking very milk tray man with your black top and your sleek back hair.
Yeah, it's my Steve Jobs look. I've got like 8 of these jumpers, white t-shirt underneath. So yeah, it's my don't have to think about what clothes to wear. I just kind of wear the same outfit. That's not true, by the way. But you shouldn't make a joke like that at the start because people think it's true.
Just reducing your cognitive load, mate. Excellent work.
Yeah, exactly.
Mate, look, thanks. And are you well? Are you in good form?
Yeah, all good. Post Christmas, Christmas actually for us was fine in the end. It wasn't stuck in Bath, but that's fine. We had a good one, and now back into it. Busier than we expected in January, so all good.
Nice, good. And I mean, do you want to give people a quick summary of your life in rugby and now your life in multiple sports, really? Now,
yeah, I guess it's nice to rarely talk about the rugby bit that much now. I kind of might say, played a bit or kind of came up in the game. You talk about the business first and then say, oh, by the way, I played a bit of rugby. But my rugby career in a sporting family, dad obviously played England and the Lions and Liverpool. So that's his club in Lancashire in the North when it was back then. Then I played at school and then played professionally for Oral Harlequins and Connacht. So scrapping around as a lot of people do. And then ended up playing semi-professionally at Isha for 5 seasons in the Championship, which I think got my love of the game back, actually. I didn't particularly, looking back, you think you loved it, and then you go, do you know what? I didn't really enjoy that. But finished off at Isha. And then, as with a lot of ex-players or players coming towards the end of their careers, like, what do I want to do next? And inevitably didn't know. So spent a bit of time looking at different things. Worked for my agent's company selling sports kit, Top Mock Sports. They were brilliant to me. So that was good fun for a bit. And then was like, well, what do I want to do? Moved into headhunting, deliberately went away from sport for a while. So joined a headhunting firm, so executive search in the chemical and energy sectors, working across Europe. So completely different and loved it. Did that for 3.5, 4 years. The company called Miramar, Andy Ross, still good mates of mine, who took me on. And they had a load of experience and I was kind of scrapping around trying to figure out what to do, but had like a light bulb moment of being in Germany, I think it was in Cologne, and we were doing 3 different searches for roles across 3 different sectors and 3 different industries. And I was still playing at Isha. And I was looking at it, I go, why doesn't sport do this? Like, we were doing the same process and the same rigor, same questions, different answers, of course, but like, I'm pretty sure sport doesn't do this. And I was thinking particularly of the performance people. You know, I look at the impact of coaches, S&C guys, physios in my career, good and bad, predominantly good. And I'm thinking, geez, those guys can impact players hugely. Why isn't a rigorous process put around it? So that's how it started. I spoke to a few contacts in rugby and they're like, no, there is a bit of a gap actually to bring that process and rigor into sport. So that's how it started. And that was, geez, that was a while ago. That's 7 or 8 years ago. And we have started in rugby, worked with a couple of premiership teams. We've worked with about half the premiership now. And also working, we do more work outside of rugby. So football, cricket, cycling, tennis, Olympic sports.
Nice. And with my rugby badger hat on, my first question I wrote down was, what was your best memory of rugby? And you said something that resonated with me again, like probably discovered my love in the National Leagues.
Yeah, do you know, going back to, and there is a reality that you can be a good leader, but if you're not a very good player, you're not going to get much opportunity to show that leadership capability. So the Championship was probably a nice level for me because I was suddenly one of the better players. And, you know, one of those guys who, if you get a run of games, you'll get picked. But every time you get injured, you have to start again at the bottom. And I always got injured. So you're constantly trying to prove yourself almost. But yeah, going to Ishii, you suddenly walk into a room and people are there because they love it. They don't have to be. They're not really getting paid. And it just suddenly, yeah, you get your passion for it back. And listen, I absolutely love my time at Oral, then at Quit. I mean, Oral was brilliant, like late 90s, early 2000, tough place to play, but really good fun, really good people. And you know, all I ever wanted to do was play professionally. So to then go to Harlequins was just a dream. To play in the Premiership was fantastic. And then also to play in the Celtic League at the time, you think arrogantly that the way things are done in England, well, is the way things are done. And then you go to Ireland and it felt not less professional, just different. And you're like, oh no, this is almost better. This is making me improve more. And it, so it just opened your eyes to how to do things and how important environments are and cultures. So, and then coming back to Ishii, yeah, I kind of loved it. What's my favorite memory? It's a tough one, that kind of playing at Quinn's in the Heineken Cup was my debut with four British Lions, was quite a big one. And playing well, you know, that was a nice memory. Winning National One for Ishii was brilliant. You know, we had a season where we won every game bar one. And, you know, that was just so much fun. Like, winning doesn't matter what level it is. Like, it feels just as good. So the 1 year we were in National One was great. So they're the things that jump out.
Good league, National One. Lots of good trips.
Lots of good trips.
Top rugby clubs.
Especially when you're winning. So there's a lot of good bus trips back, and it is national. So, you know, we'd be at Wharfdale and we'd be at Redruth. And yeah, great fun, great fun.
Nice. I'm going two more rugby badger questions.
Okay.
Best player you played with?
With? I think the one that made you look the best was probably Will Greenwood, because he just made all your decisions for you at 12. You know, it made it so easy. You didn't really have to make any decisions. And so that was the person who probably made the most impact in, you know, making me look good. And then in the same team, when he was at his best, Keith Wood was on another planet.
I thought you just played Keith Wood. I thought you got to. Yeah.
Well, he's on another planet. He could be on great form chatting, and he just flicked a switch and he went somewhere else, and it was unbelievable to see in person because he became a different person, and he would run through walls for you, and so they stand out. I mean, that's obviously the highest standard. There's underrated players at Connacht. John Muldoon is an outstanding, you know, warrior, and there's a few others as well, but yeah, they stand out.
And last question, sorry, I'm rugby badgering. Which coach got the best out of you?
I think there was a period at Harlequins where Richard Hill took me under his wing a little bit and just spent time with me, which had a really big impact. You know, I mean, my dad obviously coached me at school and then at Oral, so he would have, you know, undoubtedly had the biggest impact. But Richard Hill was the other one that, you know, just took me aside. And as somebody who, you know, for somebody who was feeling, probably lacked a bit of self-belief, somebody who was so ingrained in how to practice, and to, you know, it was so helpful to go, right, we're going to go away and we're going to practice this stuff. And so that was the person who probably invested the most time in me.
Nice, Mike. Rugby badgering over. Tell me, look, I'm really curious now. And you said, I'm pretty sure sport doesn't do this. So there must have been something you noticed as a player or someone in the sports environment that was thinking, as I was definitely at the time, well, how did, why did we choose that person to be coach of this team? And why not other people? So what kind of sparked your curiosity?
Well, I just think, you know, when you're in and rugby maybe as a new professional sport, how it felt was that you would try things because it's a new thing. You know, being professional is a new thing. And so I think rugby felt itself to be quite innovative and quite open and therefore quite professional. I think that's, you know, I always get the idea that it looked down its nose at footballers. Oh, they're not that professional. They, you know, they train in the morning and that's it. And so the definition of professionalism, I think rugby felt it got. And yet when I went to work in industry, having only played sport, you know, most of my life, you're in working in these big corporate businesses and you look at how they're assessing people and how they're looking at the wider team, where specific roles fit in, what are the criteria that these people need? And you're like, I wonder if, I doubt, does sport do that? Does it actually look at, say, a head coach and go, what's the other rest of the team look like? Where's the squad now? What type of coach do we want? And asking these sorts of questions. I didn't know that it didn't. But when speaking to a couple of kind of CEOs that I knew, it appeared that maybe, as with a lot of things, it was when the moment came for hiring, and often the people making the hiring decisions, and this is not a criticism, it's just the reality, a lot of people making the hiring decisions don't have any performance background. So how are they going to know what a good coach looks like, really, apart from maybe the media or somebody's experience? So my gut just said, I'm just seeing how, you know, how detailed and professional the process was that we went through to hire, you know, senior commercial directors or global business directors in the chemical sector. I'm thinking, yeah, that's a really rigorous process and quite nuanced when you get down to it. I just thought, pretty sure sport doesn't do that. Oh, this coach is available. Why don't we get him? I just had the feeling that that was maybe how it went.
Nice. And fast forward a lot of years. where have you got to now? What's the process that you find helps people make, you know, I guess, better, more informed choices?
Great question. I think we've got to a few different places with different sports, actually. So within rugby, like we see it, there's four stages to a process when you're hiring somebody in a very good coach selection process. And typically, and we've been involved in these processes, people that jump in at like the end of stage three. So what they'll do is they'll go, do you know who's available? Yeah, that's often the first thing. I'm like, well, everybody's available. I mean, that's the first, you know, because you can buy people out of contracts. So, you know, if you're looking financially, everybody is available. And rugby has a really, contracts are sacrosanct, you know, in the sense of most people have full-time contracts, whereas it's fixed term typically in sport, which is quite unique in general industry. And what people do is they'll go, oh, what do you think of this person? And if you have a committee of, say, four or five people who are making this decision in the club, they'll go, oh, yeah, he's good. And somebody else will go, yeah, yeah, I know him. And then suddenly you've got an agreement in a room where nobody's discussed what the criteria was for selecting this person. They just know him. And it's always a him. Probably another discussion to have. And you kind of, so what, and we've done this with the Premier
League. Why is it always a him?
Well, you tell me. I don't know. I mean, it shouldn't be. And actually in America, you can see in the NFL, there are some female coaches going in. And you look at what, if you look at, and I think the way we approach it, I think there will absolutely be more female coaches coming into the game, because a lot of the qualities that you're looking for are things that would lend itself, you know, if you look at emotional intelligence, you look at all these different things. There's no reason why women shouldn't be coaching men's sport at all.
Agree. I mean, if we were to sell it in terms of cognitive diversity, I think it's, and I know loads of really, really, really competent female coaches, as an example. And I mean, I cite this example a lot, but Canada went to a World Cup without any Canadian coaches. And basically with a couple of, you know, people who were players coaching, and, you know, I've been to Canada and there's some phenomenal coaches, male and female, and they could have easily taken two female coaches and possibly done even better.
Yeah. I think the problem is if you don't have a proper process, and granted, I've massively biased here because this is what we do, but I think if you don't have a proper process that has a criteria base to it where you decide what you're going to prioritize and what are the things that are important, you are going to go back to the norm, to the cultural norm, and the cultural norm is men who have done it before. So how do you, and especially now, if you look at kind of diversity broadly, if you're looking at people wanting more, you know, cognitive diversity, but the whole range, And this isn't, you know, an ethical or moral issue. It's a performance one, because diverse teams outperform homogenous ones. So if you can get within your coaching team a diverse range of people from different backgrounds, it'll make the group stronger. And I think we never look at coaches in isolation. So if we're hiring a head coach, you need to know who else is there. And the reality is, if you want to hire for diversity, you have to hire for potential, because you can't be what you can't see. So if you look at what the FA is doing with their BAME initiatives, which are, you know, leading the way, frankly, suddenly they're, you know, people from that from those communities, if you're a black coach, younger black coach, you can now see people getting opportunities further up. So you go, oh, do you know what? Maybe I can do this. And so, and that's a really big issue. But I think this criteria-based approach, if you decide there's five traits and dig into what a good coach is and what's important for your team, suddenly you broaden out the scope of what's possible. And that's not done enough.
Well, give me an example. What type of words do you hear a lot? What type of skills, traits come up?
So I get, in terms of what the criteria are.
Yeah. So when you're sitting down with a club and going, look, what is it that you're looking for? What type of things do you hear the most?
So you've effectively got two basic approaches. And, you know, some people are like, we need somebody. These are the type of comments that you get. So, you know, you've got people who are like, we need a winner. We need somebody who, and we're like, okay, fine. We need somebody who's coached at this level before, who's got the experience, who's got the credibility, who, I mean, I think, do you not want somebody who develops players? Is that not kind of the most important thing? So there is often a kind of, wrongly, but there's definitely a kind of like, do we want somebody who's proven, who's been there and done it? Or do we want somebody who develops players? And they're not always the same thing. Sometimes they are. Sometimes you get outstanding. And you also get some muddying of the waters around, is this a head coach who is overseeing other coaches? Is it somebody who is on the grass day in, day out? Are they managing the program? Do they need some specific technical expertise? So within the group, you might have a particularly strong defense coach. Or so if you look at the five criteria, the only one that we always have is cultural fit. So we kind of break down every role to kind of 50% culture, 50% capability. And what that means is if you don't get the fit right, the person's not going to last very long at all. So are they aligned when it comes to values, when the type of person who will fit into that organization? And that doesn't mean that they're all the same. You know, cultural ad might be a better phrase. But somebody who, you know, the example we use the most, so Anna, my business partner, worked in the corporate sector previously. And we can use sport examples here, but it can be a bit inflammatory. So if you look at Amazon and Lego were her two biggest clients, and they are as far apart as can be culturally. So Amazon, Lego, family business, death by a thousand cuts, absolute consensus needed to make decisions. They'd rather not make a decision than make a decision not everybody agreed with. And then Amazon is all about it's all about the individual and what you have done. So poles apart, not wrong or right. Well, you might definitely lean one way or another, but you couldn't possibly function in the same, you know, for the same role in those different places, you couldn't function. So that cultural fit is massively important. And then you look into.
I actually had a conversation with a coach today around some, and that would be my view. I talked about like competence, character, like, and actually for me, the character was like, would it be the right kind of fit? Let's call it.
Yeah.
But in my opinion, and I don't know, I mean, there is no point even talking about this competence stuff if this stuff, because this is going to be an expensive decision for you if you get this one wrong, because it's going it's going to impact heavily upon other people as well as this person.
Yeah. Well, and you talk, a lot of talk's been said about the kind of All Black song stuff with no dickheads, as if, well, every team has that in the world. Like it's not, you know, or maybe not. Sometimes if somebody's got a lot of, is proven, suddenly they're allowed to be, you know, maybe don't set the same standards as everybody else. And as soon as that happens, you are screwed, because, you know, the best player, the best person has to have the highest standards and be the best person. You know, you don't get to be less a good person the more talent you have. And I think sometimes people make that mistake, and it's understandable. I guess that if you look at what we pull out of coaching positions is, is there a specific type of coach? So is there a, there might be coaching philosophy or leadership philosophy or strategic planning or technical skill, or there'll be four or five things that we'll narrow it down to. And there might be, so cultural fit is one, there might be personal style, how somebody comes across, how they act, how they interact with others. There might be like development mindset. So there's a ton of them. And we've done over 200 searches, over 1,000 different criteria, but we had loads of time last March because we had no work. So we sat down and we went, could we put these into a few like buckets, all of these, of all the searches we've ever done across all different roles, can we narrow it down to a few, you know, as I say, distinct buckets? And we did, we managed to narrow it down to only nine. And I think you've got quite, more simply, there's like three which are more kind of practitioner, technical based, and six which were more kind of leadership, kind of communication, planning. And it's just interesting when you look at it, and especially if you look at it when you go, if so we've done some work for the FA and FIFA on this, of like the technical director's course, often people go from a head of recruitment to a technical director, and it's just worse route. As if you look at it, you go from the most operational person in a team to the most strategic. So not saying that you can't have people who do that, and there's some really good examples of people who've done it well, but it's just looking at the skills you need to develop on your journey. And if you're going from a technical coach to a head coach, for example, it's a completely different skill set. And the best technical coach doesn't necessarily make the best head coach. And it's something that's, I think, often overlooked. And then support isn't put in. You know, we talked about this before, about the support you put around coaches. The support then isn't put in to help that person thrive and reach their potential. And I think that's something that is nearly always missed out. So if I say three out of four stage processes, recruiting people, stage four is the bit that nearly always gets left off. Not always, but, and it's a kind of KPIs. How are you measuring this person and how do you help them improve?
So what I think I'm hearing is, who's going to make the decision? You sit down and then kind of co-create and discuss what's the kind of key attributes. And part of that is also like looking at what we've currently got in terms of our environment, but also the skills we have. It would be like the spotlight kind of empty chair. What are we missing? What's the stuff that, what strengths do we need to add to this team to make it even more effective?
Yeah.
Then you're into the bit that most people get excited about. Let's call them interviews. And then after that, it's the bit that, you know, it's, I guess it's co-creating or agreeing this is the stuff that's successful for us, and how do we support you? What's the stage three? Like, what's the stuff where you think people have broken some rules and done it a little bit differently? Because that can be quite a homogenous
process. Yeah, so I think there are the four stages, you're right. The first stage is deciding who's making the decisions, pretty much. So what's the committee that you're doing? How are you communicating it internally and externally? Because especially for a lot of these, they're high profile. So things get leaked all the time. And you've got to manage that. And you don't want to underestimate the power of the media. And you can use it to your advantage. So that's stage one. And also people get, as soon as somebody starts talking, people get hijacked by their emotions and pressure gets applied. And you make, you know, rash decisions, or you speed things up when you shouldn't. So that's stage one. Seems very simple, but actually there are a few stages. Stage two is
something I was thinking about with stage one, and is, I'm thinking of like Mo Boback's role with ECB, like as an independent. Yeah. To what extent would you suggest that having some element of independence, and I guess you provide a bit of that as well,
is
helpful to this process?
Yeah, you do need in this process an external person, because otherwise you get that kind of groupthink. You know, the hippo, the highest paid person's opinion, just saying, giving a view, and then everyone going, yeah, of not wanting to. And that's what our role has become, of just going, really? Or just being able to ask the stupid question of like, well, why did you do it that way? Or why do you think that? Or what's the objective? What's the vision of the future? Or what are your strategic objectives on the performance side for the next 3 to 5 years? Oh, you don't have any. Okay, maybe we need to go back. You know, so I think you can just ask questions that, and yeah, Mo would be a brilliant person. You know, he's probably quite busy now, but I think he would be a brilliant person to get in to do that. But yeah. So yeah, that's stage one. The stage two is just deciding what the selection criteria is. And until you've done those first two bits, you can't really go to the market because you're not assessing kind of apples for apples, are you? You kind of what it is that you decide to look for. And I think, you know, people can do it themselves. And I think, you know, there is a lot of coaches have agents. So at the point where people know something's happening, you will get agents approaching CEOs or owners. And so and that's why for us, it's not a search process, it's a selection one. So it's deciding of the people. I mean, there might still be some search if you want to, you know, unearth a gem that isn't really that known about, but most people speak to you and I want to know who the best up and coming coach is. that process would be, and listen, that's our bit. That's the bit we kind of spend a bit of time on, but there's like research of making sure you've mapped the market. There's then initial reach out to have conversations. And most people are open to a role, but they don't want to go directly and speak to the person at the club. So you want to, so we have a lot of conversations just about the type of club they are, what the role's like, because people are the risk averse, because you don't want to go into a role. So we're really, I've learned the hard way this is that initially in our role, you kind of, you're not selling an opportunity so much because you have to be honest and it has to fit for both sides. So the more honest you are, the more open they are often, because you kind of go, okay, that's what it's like. Oh, there's an opportunity to grow it. Okay, they're underperforming this team. Okay, they've got some good young players or whatever it might be. And then you can unpick as soon as you start speaking to people and asking good questions. I mean, you know, this is as well as anybody, asking good questions is the key to unlocking potential and understand how people think. And as soon as you do that, as long as you've got some evidence they've done some work before, that's how you get to the best people we find. And it is consistent across any sport. You know, I've clearly played rugby. I've not played football, apart from under 11 Sefton champions, or cricket. I've never played tennis. And yet we have selected senior coaches in those sports and we've gone with the same process. And you can tell who the best coaches are by having conversations with them. You've got to unpick things, but you don't need to have technical know-how, in my opinion. To be able to tell who the best coaches are. I hope you disagree with that.
No, I would agree. I mean, there was two other things that I was thinking about, partly because it came up in discussion today, was, and you mentioned the word potential, like, so how do we know that? And then the second thing was like short-term versus long-term. So often I think in development positions, we are going, look, we want someone who's here for the long haul. And is this stuff that comes up in your, I guess for you there, because it's about relationships and connections over time. But sometimes, you know, I can look at some teams and I'll go, I understand why they got that coach, because they're about to get relegated and they brought in big Sam Allardyce and he'll do a job for 3 months. Do you know what I mean? So are those also part of these initial discussions, like short-term, long-term potential? What is it? How are we going to work out if that's the case?
It's unpicking kind of what people's understanding of what good looks like as well, because, you know, there are massive biases. You know, I told you a story before. Like, we've got a partnership with a data analytics business in football called 21st Club. And so we've got this partnership where we had it for about 3 years and brought it together because we thought we find a lot of really good information through our interviewing and through referencing and those sorts of things. But they've got information whereby you can see kind of style of play, you can see how many youth players they've played, you know, they've got kind of the objective information and we've got subjective. And well, that's how I looked at it idealistically, but when you unpick it, actually all the information is subjective, really.
What do you mean by that? So you said that to me beforehand as well, but
yeah, so what I mean is that for every, so they would have a metric for, say, performance of a manager or head coach, and it would be out of 100, and somebody's, you know, Jurgen Klopp's 98, and I don't know, somebody pressing North End, whoever's, you know, will be lower. And you look and you unpick as to how those numbers get pulled out. And there's still a person deciding how to measure that metric. So it's not an absolute given. There's still interpretation in those numbers. And so that's all I mean. And so, yeah, we went through this process. We, you know, recruited a head coach in the championship last year. And what we thought we would do is say, these are the people through the data who's really good, through our insight of knowing the market, here are the coaches. And in reality, that's not what happened. You know, we kind of thought, oh yeah, we're going to give you all this information and you're going to absolutely know, we're going to influence you massively. And what we did is, all we did is, like, the chairman of this club had, he knew what he wanted. We just helped, we didn't change his, you know, his understanding. We just helped him understand the decisions he'd already made. And I think suddenly being able to say, he's like, you know, we think this coach is really good because he plays, you know, a lot of youth players. And we're like, he doesn't, you know. And I think as soon as you can put that information in front of people, especially when they're non-performance people, it's quite powerful, because we want to support them. You know, we're not here to undermine them. We want to help. And I think it's very difficult if you're in those positions and you don't have a performance background, to know which way to go. And you're going to be influenced by different things. So,
yeah, it's fascinating, isn't it? Because I'm thinking of how many people will make decisions who wouldn't have that much of an understanding of performance. And then I'm also, so I think what I heard you say is that, and I would concur, the 21st Club do some cool stuff around, like, so looking at, well, actually, does this guy play with a high press? And does he, you know, does he help players, you know, improve them and they go up to better teams? But 21st Club would help you, give you some information that would help people understand better the decisions that they're making.
Well, and I'll give you the example that kind of leads to that. Is, we had a situation where we had a list of 82 coaches who'd been presented by agents in a couple of days. And so we said we would unpick that based on the metrics that we discussed were the most relevant. So style of play, performance, you know, the youth players, that sort of stuff. And we then presented it to the chairman, who picked his first choice of somebody he was interested in. We couldn't see, he wasn't on the first page. I'm like, why? And he was like, right at the bottom. So straight away, the guys in 21st Club just fell off their chairs. They're like, what's the point? they were like, oh, well, that's not right. You know, I was very close behind them. And Anna, who had no football or performance background, but she'd worked in business for 20 years and understood how to manage people, just kind of said, okay, why has he chosen that person? And she kind of brought it back and was able to go, do you know what? That was the point of, okay, let's understand why he thinks that important. And as soon as we did, we were able to kind of eliminate that person, actually, but also highlight some others that would suit the reasoning behind. His criteria wasn't actually what he said. And that's totally fine. Totally fine. And so, but equally, the person who ended up getting hired was, and he said it, he was brilliant. He said, you know, there's no way we would have hired this person without the process, because he'd never coached in the championship before. In fact, he was coaching in the 17s. So you're kind of like, and yet he was renowned. We knew he was an outstanding development coach and they had a really good squad. So I think it just shows that it's taking people on the journey to get them to a place where they're really confident that the decisions they're making are based on sound principles, because you and I know that you can make the right decision at the moment and you can still lose. And the biggest thing we hear all the time, and it drives me mad, is the thing that, you know, the thing that gets me is when somebody goes, oh, do you know what? We'll just see if that's the right decision in a couple of years. And I'm like, no, because that's not how you make decisions. You make sure that you put a criteria now where it's the right decision today, and then you support that position to help them. You know, you can't look at hindsight in that way.
stage three. What am I thinking? I'm thinking, like, and we're talking coaches, so I'll keep it there. Like, I would want to see them coach. I would probably want to speak to the players that left the clubs they played for, that they coached. I would also want to speak to the players that, you know, stayed with them a bit, and as to why. I would want to get some data around that. What's going on? What's actually happening?
Yeah, and I'd agree with that up to a point, because I think what we found from experience, that if you've got anybody who's progressive in any way, who's challenging the status quo, if you reference 5 or 10 people, there'll be somebody who hates them. Like, that's just a given. And we found referencing, the reality is, from having done it hundreds of times now, is that it often says more about the person who's giving it than it does about the person who they're giving it for. And it's really important to do, but just think about the lens that the person's coming through. So yeah, that's, I agree. You want to get as much data points as possible, then triangulate that to make a decision. But yeah, you want to speak to players and you want to understand the work that they've done from as many sources as possible.
What's the stuff that you think that you've seen or you've been part of that you think's been really helpful during stage three?
I think what we found really useful is making this is one thing we do, which is a bit of a secret, but we make sure that they get interviewed by more than one person. So within our business, there'll be more than one person because that differing views is really important. We try and get them to, you know, if you look at potential, there is a way to do interviews and the way you ask questions to assess it quite, I say accurately, to really understand how people think. So there needs to be, you know, in the same way of scouting players, you know, many eyes, many times, it's kind of, there's a similar approach to speaking to these people as many times as possible. And we end up, once you get on a shortlist of say 4 or 5 people, you speak to them almost every other day and you start to get to know them outside of, you know, they become, some of them do become friends as you get down the line, but you start to understand more about them. So I think it seems really obvious, but the more, if a couple of people can speak to them and in different situations and in different places, and you want to check some of their skills out. So if they're coaches, you want to see them coach. You want to understand if they're a head coach, what's their vision for the future? How do they, you know, you want to see how they present that information because they're going to need to do it to players and to staff and to owners. And it's important that you can do that well. So if somebody says, oh, I just want to coach on the grass. Well, if you're a head coach, you need to do more than that. So,
a couple of things I'm thinking about there. I would always point people towards the Heineken interview. I don't know if you've seen the YouTube clip. It's beautiful. And the second one that I'm really interested in, and I'm sure you've got some secret ways of identifying potential. Something I heard in some teaching interviews was they would teach the lesson. They would then have a conversation, some feedback, and then they teach the lesson again and actually look at whether someone could move from a 5 to a 6 as opposed to going from a 7 to a 7. So actually, did we feel like this person would progress quickly and had, you know, some potential there? I guess.
Yeah, and one of the things we...
Sorry, go on, mate.
Yeah, one of the things we say is that there's no small things. So the number of times people have said, I know this is only a small thing, but... And then the thing they explained was something that this person did, which highlighted their character and personality brilliantly. So somebody who, you know... We interviewed this person and you know what? He had watched a game and he wasn't from the sport, but he had done this and he did just write a note back for this and he did do that. And you're like, no, that's really telling. You know, these things, everything matters in a way and it shows the type of person that you are. So there's a sense of humility. So it's happened so often that people have said that conversation, that sentence is that it's only a small thing, but, and then they've explained why the person's good. Like, it's not small then, is it?
it's a good, I like that. I'm stealing that. And what you notice across different sports, is there like some themes that you're going, actually in football it's more like this, in rugby we're here?
Yeah, I think that there are absolutely kind of cultural norms that are powerful, and you don't want to rule people out because they've been in a bad environment, because the environment can really shape people. And so you know we always try and give people the benefit of the doubt, really. And just, you know, see, it sounds cheesy, doesn't it? But you want to see the best in people and see, you know, if you were put in a good environment, you might do really well. You know, so kind of some of the work that we're most proud of is when somebody's been at a smaller club or in a difficult environment and they've gone somewhere else with better people around them in a better environment and they've done brilliantly. I think that's where it's very easy to go, we're going to take him from Man City and put him at Liverpool, or, you know, go from a big club to a big club because it makes you feel secure. But actually, by going through a proper process and deciding what good looks like and what are the type of traits you want and character, you can find people who, you know, just haven't been given the opportunity.
Yeah, and, I think I've seen 21st Club present on some of that stuff around how they've tried to work out, like, if you're coaching a team that are like seventh in the championship, and what might that look like over here? But at least it's an attempt to go, look, let's take this person from this context and try and put some data around how they might go in a slightly different context with perhaps better players. It always reminds me of Bob Muir, who said, like, you know, are elite coaches, do they like dress better or they just work with better players? I mean, what does the word elite mean?
Yeah.
I've seen lots of people I think are excellent coaches and they just don't happen to be working with some of the best players in the world.
Yeah, I know. And you look at it, we've seen people who are at, say, you know, a League Two team, like a academy manager at Cambridge or something. And, you know, England women's head coach. So when Phil Neville got appointed, we led that search and you're speaking to people in the women's game and you're like, just so respectful of the work that some of these people have done, men and women, and they've done it for nothing. And they've done it for years. You know, of all the people, you know, if you had to ask one question, you'd ask, you know, how did you get in? How did you grow up? Or how did you get into coaching? And suddenly you realize you can't fake that passion you can fake that passion, but you can't fake the story of how you got into coaching and what you ended up doing. And, you know, suddenly when you hear somebody who worked, you know, got an hour bus journey to go to coach for 3 hours and then had to be up at 6 a.m. to go back to school and coach at school. And then, and you're like, geez, you have committed your life to your craft and you've just never been given opportunity because the way people run these processes, they look for the person who's been there and done it already. And there's just a load of opportunity and potential out there that's being missed.
Yeah. One of Andy Friend's questions he always asked players that he mentioned on the pod was, what was your toughest time and how did you come through it? And he just said, that's a really important question for me to ask and to get some insight into people.
Good question.
I'm really curious about stage four. So why don't we do it? What's the stuff that means that the four-stage process is often a three-stage process?
Yeah. Why don't we do it? I think in its simplest form, if you're a CEO, chairman, owner, if you're the non-performance person making that decision and this person's going in at the top of, if he's a director of rugby or head coach, the head coach tends to be in rugby the senior person. So why would you develop him? You know, if you look at the Olympic model of performance director and head coach, if you've got somebody alongside them or reporting into them, there's as much on the performance director to make sure the head coach is getting the development they need to produce the coaching they need to get winning performances. So the model's different. So partly some of these people are well known. So, you know, you're not going to get a CEO. I'm not going to give advice to that person. He's really well known. You know, surely he's there. Same as players. You know, the example I like, Liverpool fan, Fernando Torres signing for Chelsea for £50 million. And, oh, he's the finished article. We don't need to help him. And then he didn't really do anything there. You know, he's somebody you need to put an arm around. You know, it's kind of like you need the idea that you've made it and don't need development is just complete rubbish. Like you can always, in my eyes, you can always develop. And I think the second you stop thinking that you can, you're screwed. So partly that. And then there's not a framework for it to be put into the culture of a club. Yet you develop players, but you don't develop yourself. It doesn't make any sense. And I think a lot of coaches are absolutely crying out for it. I mean, I know this is obviously what you do. So that's probably why. And I think we always say that nobody's more than 80% fit against any theoretical brief. So there is always, when we present it, if we say those numbers are kind of approximate, but if you've got five criteria, it's very rare that somebody nails all five. So typically there'll be four things that they're good at and one thing for development. And so and because we present people as real human beings who are flawed, we never sell, oh, this is the guy for you. You know, we've had situations where agents have presented three coaches to us and said, these guys are all perfect fits. You know, I'm like, well, first of all, how can they all be? And how do you know what the brief is? But as soon as you go 80% and they're real and they're human and they're flawed, you straight away go, like everyone, okay, well, we can help these people get even better. So if you can get something from 80 to 90, and also I think for players, if it's my view, but if you're looking at the coaches are trying to get better as well, that's quite inspirational. You know, it's a really great example. So I just think, you know, the old school leader who's at the top, who it's hierarchical and that person, you just do what he says. I'm not saying it's that clear cut. That's a bit too black or white, but I think the traditional nature of these roles means that that's why coaches don't get developed.
Yeah, mate. I get it. I guess something else I'm curious about is players leaving playing positions and going straight into kind of coaching roles. What's your experiences around that? I'm guessing that would definitely necessitate stage four more than perhaps in other situations. But what's been your experience around that?
I think it's tough because often people will go, they might go into academy coaches, they might go into first team coaching. They might not have the most experience, but they've definitely got something about them, you know? And so they get given opportunities. And it's counterproductive sometimes for people to be given these opportunities so quickly because they haven't had the time to kind of step away. You know, they're having a transition from player to coach, and there needs to be a gap. You know, you need that gap. And I think, you know, I mentioned Anna, my business partner, she's just written a master's on this exact topic, like transition in sport. And that liminality, it's called, of kind of the void of going from one stage to another. And so I think, yeah, absolutely. If you love your sport, if you love rugby, be a coach. You know, I see actually too many people who love their sport and love rugby go out of the sport because they just think, do you know what? I need a break. And I know, but you don't want to do anything else. So just stick with it and, you know, learn the ropes, you know, coach in the academy or the community. So I think often need a bit more of a gap between finishing playing and coaching because you don't know, you know, you'll put way too much emphasis on your experience, on what it was like for you, when actually that's not probably as relevant as you think. So, because everyone's experience is different. So I think it's a great thing to stay in the game and for people to, if you're passionate for coaching, get into coaching. But too often people get to first team, I think, who are good players or big name players, when actually they need to learn their craft a bit. And I think
something I was thinking about that with that as well was also like, what about and where's your viewpoint around like multiple environments that people have been in, and so that will hopefully give them, you know, more experiences, some different challenges that would be helpful.
Oh, it's vital. It's vital. Now, if you're, I don't know, if you're playing, you play at Leicester Tigers and you play your whole career there, and then you retire, and it's not to say, by the way, it's not to say that these people can't do brilliantly. Because maybe they're just a really diverse, interested, curious person who's well-travelled and all those things. But I think whenever we, for any role that we do, especially performance roles, you know, we look for different sports and different environments. And the power of doing those two things is strong. And, you know, it doesn't happen nearly enough. Not nearly enough that people go to a different country. Because it is different. It is just different how people operate and what works in different countries. So you know, I think more clubs should actually think, okay, this is a player who's got potential. Let's put a plan. Let's partner with another club. I'm not saying it doesn't happen because I can think of two people that it did happen with, but go to the Southern Hemisphere, spend some time and then come back and actually report back to the group, you know? So yeah, we're massive advocates for that. We think it's really important.
Yeah, agree. Last question. Like,
yeah,
what jobs do you think will exist in the future, or what do you think there'll be more of? Or what do you see in other sports that, like, you know, rugby or any other sports would have? I mean, in my head, I'm thinking about, it's just not normal to have a psychologist involved in a rugby team, which I think is mind-blowing. And then the other one is, I think it's even less likely that they've got someone to support their coaches. So,
yeah.
I was going to say, I know obviously football has kind of a head of coaching, and I think they'd have more psychology in my experience. But I mean, yeah, what are the stuff you're seeing or hearing, or what are your thoughts on those two examples of roles?
Yeah. I mean, you haven't teed this up. I didn't know you were going to ask this question, but I have written a series of articles on this in football for a website called Training Ground Guru. So I chose five for them. So it was, but they weren't necessarily roles that weren't around. So it was kind of like sporting director. So somebody who is the strategic lead of on the performance side of an organization, who is not the coach, not the head coach, which I think is like vital. There was a head of high performance. So somebody who is kind of on a level with the coach. You look at the Australian system, Aussie Rules, NRL, they do have, there's a bit more of a peer-to-peer relationship with that senior person, which doesn't happen in the UK as much. We said ahead of people and team development. So the idea, so the psychology piece, the kind of the identity, culture, standards, that sort of stuff, it's too much to expect the coach to do that too. You know, so you do need somebody who's necessarily responsible. So the Gilbert Anoko of the All Blacks, that sort of person, yeah, who would run the leadership group, who would hold people to account, who would help and support. And so we did some work with the FA on that. And I think the psychology piece, too often people look at it as kind of mental skills. And there is that side of it, and that's vitally important. That's on pitch. But there's like an off-pitch element as too about, there's so little done about kind of team dynamics and group dynamics and how you actually bond and feel like you belong as a team. If you look at a lot of successful teams, they really have that deeply. So that's the other one we did, I think, director strategy and analytics. So there's still, the analytics is still relatively basic compared to other sports in rugby. So not a criticism, it's just where the game is and how, it's actually not the level, it's just how do you use your analysis and how do you make sure that it's used across different areas of the club and of organizations. And that's something that is very few teams have. And then there was one more. What was the last one? I can't remember. I think heads of coaching. Absolutely. It's staggering to me. There isn't that, because who has the biggest impact on players? 100% coaches. So why aren't those people getting developed and to help develop the players? You know, there's a really quite traditional way of looking at it in terms of S&C and physio, absolutely vital roles, don't get me wrong, but we'd be big advocates of that kind of coach development broadly. I can't believe I've forgotten the last role, but
I'll share the article when we send it out. It's the Training Ground Guru one. Who knows, coaches might need coaches too, who knows.
But of course they do, because if they're in the same way that, you know, 54% of CEOs in the FTSE 100 have executive coaches. So over half. And that's off their own bat. So they're doing that on their own. That stat might be a year old, but that's what the number was. And you're looking at it and you go, whether it's a CEO, whether it's the director of rugby, head coach, they're the ones, it's lonely at the top. They need the most support.
Yeah.
So whether that's coaching, whether it's mentorship, whether it's leadership, or technical coaching, you know, what sort of a culture do you want? If you want a learning culture or where people get better, it's, you know, that's non-negotiable, really. You've got to have somebody like that.
Yeah, beautifully put. And actually, I think the technical director and the performance, having people around them that kind of, because it can be a very lonely, stressful job at the top. And I'm seeing some people that get older very quickly.
Yeah, it's tough. It's a tough job.
It's been a pleasure. I've loved it. What for you? So what does the next kind of 12 months hold? What are you most excited about as a business?
I think you look at what last year has been like. You know, we've done well on the search side. We're moving to selection with coaching, which has been great. We've grown, because the search has fell off a cliff, we've grown the advisory part and leadership development. So we hold some like leadership forums where we get leaders from different sports together, which has been really cool. It's like, so I think this year as a business, being totally honest, sometimes you have to take certain work, but if we can continue to develop working with people and having genuine partnerships. So we've got a couple of really nice things where we're doing some recruitment, but actually what we're doing is helping develop the people there too, and setting up programs. And there's a couple of really big things across sports, which will be exciting, and growing into Australia and America as well, which is fun. So yeah, it's all exciting stuff.
Strong work. And if people want to reach out to you, where's the best place to find?
Yeah. So I'm on LinkedIn. I am on Twitter and getting used to that now. Not quite as prolific as you, but I'm starting to figure out how to use it. So that's at Dave Slemmer thing. We've got EP Pot. This has a one as well. EPP has a thing. So yeah, LinkedIn and Twitter.
Mate. Have a cool day. Stay safe.
Cool. Cheers, Rusty. Great to see you.